This is an interview with Tom McCormick, March 14th, 2005, in Madison, Wisconsin.
Don't tell anyone, I said it's going to be.
Yeah, wait.
Is that all right if I slip up there?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I want a pint of Guinness. What would you like?
A pint of maybe an amber or something like that. Or a porter.
Sorry.
Is there a list on the back of there?
Yeah, here's the...
Alright, what's the capital season like? Do you know what it is?
Maybach?
Sure, I'll give that a try.
Okay.
So tell me about your project so I have some idea of the framework here. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I think I might have mentioned I'm working with this with Jeremy and with Tony Michaels as my advisor.
Okay, good.
And a third person. What I'm writing on is UW in the 50s and 60s.
Okay.
And I'm really kind of the idea of the project is 60s protests and kind of contextualizing that protest in terms of the Cold War and the university. Trying to look at, you know, the first couple chapters which I've drafted are about the 50s and kind of changes in the universities, kind of geared, you know, spurred by the Cold War, the expansion and enrollment, you know, emphasis on the natural sciences, those kinds of things, the increase in research budgets, the federal government expenditures, you know, dramatically rising in the 1950s and 60s, and those kinds of things. And also about kind of student politics during the 50s and, you know, the Labor Youth League, which is the communist youth group on campus, and the later Socialist Club, which shows up in the late 1950s, and some talk of McCarthyism on campus and those kinds of things. Or in some cases, the lack of McCarthyism on campus, I don't know. maybe it plays both ways, I'm not sure. I know a little bit about you. I think you told me one time, I don't know if you remember, it's got to be about 4 or 5 years now.
Sorry, it looks like we just have 7 ounces or 20 ounces for Guinness.
Okay, 7 or 20, that's not just 7 ounces.
I usually automatically just put in 20, but if you just want to
play,
it's
20.
No,
20.
Yeah.
7
is like... 7.
That's, won't even get you started.
You know, your name was familiar. I'm poor on faces.
I think it was your last semester teaching.
Yeah, because I said, Matt Levin, I know that name.
It must have been, what was that, 4 years ago that you stopped teaching?
Yeah, I think the spring of 2000, so really closer to five.
Yeah. It reminds me how long I've been here.
Sorry about that.
I don't want to think about it sometimes. But I think you mentioned at the time that you had been, were you at the University of Cincinnati or something like that as an undergraduate? Or?
Yeah, that's right,
And you had been...
I was head of the Young Republican.
Right, I thought you had told me. I put that in my notes because I keep a little file on everybody. And,
now, even though there's a Cincinnati, which is Bob Taft crowd, I was nonetheless an Eisenhower Republican.
You were.
Yes.
So that makes it better.
And
right?
I voted for Eisenhower, as a point of fact, the first time, even in 56.
Yeah.
Although I wouldn't have considered myself a Republican.
Now, how did you end up at Wisconsin? You were from Ohio?
Yeah, I grew up in Cincinnati, actually. I had a major professor, himself quite conservative guy. His name was Reginald McGrane. Economic history, more than anything else, did a book on bank crashes in the 1830s and the Jacksonian period, stuff like that. But he thought Wisconsin was the best. He was actually University of Chicago PhD, but he thought Wisconsin had the best American history department in the government.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so he kind of...
Yeah, in fact, I was in the competition for Woodrow Wilson, and they asked me the list of the three top schools you'd like to go to. And I listed Wisconsin first, and then Harvard, and then Yale, and they wanted to know why that.
They were confused.
Why weren't you? And I said foreign policy, and why aren't you going to study with Samuel Floyd Demas? And I said, well, he's a little too nationalistic and reactionary for me. So that didn't get me out of Woodrow Wilson. But mainly got steered this way. I never applied to any place else except here.
Yeah.
And I didn't get the Wilson, I just applied here, and that's, was it. But I had no idea who Fred Harvey Harrington was. I had no idea who the foreign policy historian was.
Yeah.
You know, I was, you know, pretty much a straight middle of the road to the internationalist.
And you came here in like 55 or 56?
Came in 56. Fall of 56, yeah.
Actually, do you mind if we move switch over
sure.
there?
Yeah.
I'm just let her. So this, so you didn't, you weren't aware who was here. Harrington before Williams was the foreign policy guy.
That's right. Harrington, Williams doesn't come until fall of 57. So, sorry about that. He's taping an interview with me.
Oh, yeah, that's kidding. Fine.
Yeah, thank you.
I can show up one of these doors, too, as well.
Okay,
thanks.
Whatever that's worth.
That's how you ended up here, huh?
Yeah, just the major professor telling me that's where I should go. He had two people that he thought were PhD material that year. One was a guy named Daniel Beaver. He sent him the work with Richard Leopold at Northwestern, mm-hmm. which he thought was the second best American history school, at least in the Midwest, mm-hmm. and sent me to work here with Harrington, as it turned out.
Yeah. What'd you find when you got here? As a graduate student, you weren't necessarily engaged in all this undergraduate politics stuff.
I wasn't.
Right.
I wasn't. You know, I was vaguely aware of it.
Right.
On the other hand, in a sense, I don't know if you read that piece that I did on Lefebvre and diplomatic history.
I don't think so.
Oh, you must look at that. by all means. I did a piece there. In
is that recently?
The journal, it's called Simply Called Diplomatic History. Mm-hmm. And I did a, there was a kind of, part of the edition was devoted to the work of Walter Lefebvre. Mm-hmm. And Lloyd Gardner and I, who were his seminar mates, and all TA'd with Williams in one hand, wrote the opening essay and it was an appreciation of Walt. But really it was mainly about Wisconsin here in the late 50s. and it's called Walter Lefebvre, The Making of a Wisconsin School Revisionist. You know? And so you'll find some material in there. In fact, I'll probably be a bit redundant because I'll end up saying things that I say in that piece. But
I won't
not this past issue, but the issue before.
Okay, I'm sure I won't have any problem finding it.
Yeah, October issue.
Okay.
So in some ways we get exposed to a point of view quite early just from Harrington's seminar. I mean, I had written a master's thesis on Arthur Reyes of Vandenberg and bipartisanship in American foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And it was straight sort of a liberal internationalist, sort of middle of the road between, I could have been a liberal Republican or a conservative Democrat, we'd have been from the same cloth.
Right.
And it's totally uncritical, accepts the notion of the Cold War, bipartisanship, et cetera. You know, politics stop at the water's edge, we all unify together, no dissent.
Very 1950-ish. Yeah.
Very, very, very. But it almost immediately gets shredded in the in the seminar, which we it was a bloody seminar. You had to like conflict a lot. We're all learned to like it, put it mildly.
Yeah.
But quickly got that shredded and challenged and what have you. But also, you know, while Harrington didn't come from anything like a socialist or a Marxist background,
right.
Nonetheless, he was kind of a beardy and put a lot of emphasis on economics and wouldn't let us simply do a kind of straight ideological political kind of thing. You know, where are the economics? You know, where's the nuts and bolts and all this sort of thing. So even just at that level, you immediately get exposed to different ideas. And as I write in that piece, it was a very Beardian department. It was an anachronistic department in that mm-hmm. respect. Because Charles Beard was passé in almost every other department in the country by then, mainly because it was the stuff on Roosevelt and World War II. You know. But that was earth-shaking. But also almost immediately, you get thrown in with other undergraduates, including folks that were in the Labor Youth League and the like. So, I'm a young Republican, I'm meeting guys that are communists for the first time. You know,
as a teaching assistant, you mean? Or as,
no,
or
I was meeting amongst classes? Fellow graduate students.
Oh, okay. Oh, like Marty Sklar and folks like that.
I don't know if they ever even publicly acknowledged any kind of participation, so I don't want to name
names,
if you will. You know, but folks like that mm-hmm. who you know were very bright, didn't have horns on their heads,
right.
Carried on a reasoned discourse with you regardless of your points of view. They were just regular smart graduate students. far as I can tell. Right. You know, and that itself is sort of interesting. Where you meet people through them, third world students, like from Africa. A guy from Kenya, who I think had Mama connections and the like.
Really?
And talking about, you know, we'll build a new Africa with whites in it eventually, but the white settler colonies have to go. Yeah, just have to go.
Now, some of the stuff I've read has, you know, talks about Harrington, Williams, and Howard Beale.
Yeah, yeah.
Merle Curdy.
All these folks I would characterize as Beardians.
Yeah.
Curdy, though he's writing mainly about ideas in history, the ideas are always sort of grounded in economics or demography or mobility or what have you. They always have a context.
Now, was part of the Beardian tradition a critique as well? Was that part of that, or was that?
I mean, particularly in the realm of foreign policy, Beard, as I mentioned before, gets skewed for his President Roosevelt coming to war because he says Roosevelt lied us into war.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to raise a serious issue. It's not necessarily opposition to the war, though it may well have been. But, you know, whether or not, you know, democratic societies go to war in different ways, you know, it resonates with now. in that respect, maybe a good war, but is it right to lie us into it, sort of things. But before then, he'd done several bits on foreign policy, one called The Idea of the National Interest, and then a kind of sequel to it called The Open Door at Home. And so, you know, in effect,
that's
it was sort of the John Quincy Adams stuff, you know, dunk off and monsters in search of monsters to destroy, kind of even in the name of liberty and freedom kind of thing. And then the second book, The Open Door at Home, is kind of a, you know, it's really kind of a New Deal sort of great society sort of view of how to make America a better role model for the rest of the world, and they'll automatically want to follow it anyway, because it will work so well, you know, city on the hill kind of stuff. So all these folks are influenced by that. Merrill Jensen in Colonial Revolutionary History, straight economic class analysis of the American Revolution. No ideology, just straight economics.
Yeah.
So that was the kind of atmosphere, so you imbibe a bit of that. And that predisposes you to think about alternative ways of thinking about almost anything.
Right.
You know, so. But that, and you know, as time goes on, you get, as the Socialist Club, for example, comes into being, and they hold a lot of public meetings and debates, in effect. So I remember Bill Williams debating David Shannon, who was an American social historian, on the sort of relative merits of Marxism and what have you. It's almost a prequel to the book that Williams later writes called The Great Evasion, which grew out of a joint seminar with George Mossi on Marxism in Europe and America. And The Great Evasion was evading Marx, or evading the central question of how do you square the circle between private property on one hand and the general welfare and social well-being on the other. So it's all sort of fascinating sort of time for a young guy who never exposed any of this before.
Were there any women involved in any of this? Any women in your graduate seminars?
Yes. In our own, it was a very large seminar. There must have been exceedingly maybe 16, 17 people. Very big, very big. It's the Cold War, foreign policy was in.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Vivian Monson, who was came out of an interesting background, she had been a sergeant in the Women Marine Corps. You know, yeah, there was a kind of whack version of Marines, and she'd been a sergeant in that. I can't remember what she was writing anymore. I think she finished. There's another young woman who did her master's, but didn't go beyond it. A very good friend of mine, my best friend in graduate school, many years, Barbara Walther, who started out in diplomatic history but ends up making a mark in women's history, the cult of domesticity, and things of that sort in the 19th century.
I didn't know she was from
Interesting. Yeah, she's still teaching. She's has been chair of the history department at Hunter College for years and years and years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was it. She came in the second semester. I was I won't hang myself on my words, you might quote me on this.
Be careful.
I know. But she had a rough time because it really was a bloody seminar, and it was a very male macho kind of atmosphere, even though there were women in it. You know. Harrington Whittley would each week pick two people to critique somebody else's presentation. and they read the presentation in advance, you have it ready a week in advance, and you go out and research it and tear them apart. You know, and it really was almost looking more toward developing your critical capacity.
Right.
He was almost more interested in the criticisms than he was
in the
actual presentation. You know, but that sort of institutionalized the kind of competitive kind of atmosphere. Yeah, you know? And I remember Barbara did not take kindly to it her first few times, but she had a nice sharp tongue. She could do it the best by the end of it.
I'm sure if you're a woman in graduate school in the 1950s, you better learn thick skin.
Yeah. Well, particularly came out of a small, almost convent Catholic college. I can't remember, over in Iowa someplace. I can't remember the name of it anymore. But there were things in the atmosphere as well. I mean, just not here, but everywhere. I mean, Brown versus Brown, you know, and school segregation issues were about. So it wasn't all about foreign policy or imperialism or McCarthyism or civil rights. It was making some splash, or people were thinking about it. I think, I'm trying to remember, I don't want to mislead you, but I think Ralph Abernathy was close to King. I think he comes here in the late 50s before he and King become well known. I think the Hillel Foundation brought him for a talk over just on campus.
Might have been for Wisconsin Civil Liberties Union.
I
came across it.
Did you? And he was a really impressive guy.
So you saw him? When
yeah, I heard him. Yeah, I heard him. Yeah, he was very impressive. And actually, toward the very tag end, it was almost a precursor of Freedom Rides. There were people going south. And mainly involved in not so much voter registration stuff, but that really comes later. But just a variety of things, almost just going down to learn more than anything else. You know, there wasn't organized; they didn't go to buses or anything like that. They just they a little handful to go down. You know, the guy who really would remember all this and probably what was inside it more carefully than I was, more intensely than I was. Saul Landau. Have you run across Saul in yourself?
Yeah. I tried to email him a few weeks ago because I knew he was coming to Madison.
Yeah,
he was just here.
Yeah, but I saw him about four or five times while I was here. I think they showed about 10 of his documentaries.
I was hoping to catch him while he was in town.
Yeah,
he didn't return my email. Probably was pretty busy.
Oh, I'm sure he was. But you do have his email address.
I do have his email address, and I was just talking to another old friend of his who was in the Labor Youth League, named Henry Wardus, an undergrad.
Oh, sure. I know.
It was interesting because he very carefully did not name certain names. He talked about some people, but he indicated that there were a number of people who, had not kind of publicly announced their.
And I never knew. I mean, I didn't really get to know Saul and Marty, etc. Almost through the very tag end. I was much closer with the people in the Harrington's Williams Seminar,
Lefebvre,
Gardner, and what have you. So it's not both Gardner and Lefebvre leave early, a year before I do. Walter Trenish and Lloyd just went on to Kajabi before he had the PhD. And so that last year I spent a lot of time with Carl Preeny and Saul Landau and Martin Sklar and Steve Scheinberg and Frank Chalk and folks like that. And I never really, at that point, first of all, I didn't really know their connections. And secondly, my guess is all were out by then. Hungary in 56 was the last straw for a lot of them. And there's personal issues as well, I think, in several instances. So I can't name names because I actually never knew.
Sure. Absolutely.
These are all rumor milled things at the time. Well, no, I don't know. But
I'm not sure how important some of that stuff is, anyways. Who was in what organization?
Particular. Although what was interesting is that I suspect Red Diaper Baby folks would have had were almost more attuned to the civil rights issue before most of the rest of us. And that was, I don't know if that was party line or what, or what have you, but certainly there was a terrific emphasis. And I suspect most of the folks that I suggested went south had some connection with that coterie of people.
Those that went early. Okay, so 56, Fred Harrington Seminar, 57, Bill Williams comes in fall of 57. He fits right in.
Yeah, except, I mean, more than fits in. I mean, because I mean, he's much more than a beer geek. I mean, he's influenced by Marx. He's influenced by kind of sociology of knowledge.
And he's the only one in the department who. I mean, he's not. He's not a communist, but he's the only person that has that that Marxist influence.
Yeah, although he always, as he always said, he's a Marxist with a small M. Mm-hmm. It was never a body of belief. To him, it was simply a tool of analysis. And, you know, he would use Freud, he would use Marx, he would use Mannheim, he uses this or that, you know, whatever. He was very eclectic in that respect. He's actually a Christian socialist. He was, many of the hardcore Marxists had some contempt for guys like Genovese before he became a reactionary. Because, you know, they were scientific Marxists, and he was a kind of socialist of the heart.
He was soft.
You know, he was a soft guy. You know, and there was a bit of utopianism to build in some respect. He had some notion of an ideal community that might have existed in, you know, early American society and somehow had to be recreated, but I'm not sure it ever did. But he was different in that respect. I don't know if, you know, certainly Merle Curdy, as a young man, would have thought himself as a socialist. I don't know if any of these people thought in those terms much anymore. Bill Heseltine was a member of the Socialist Party in Civil War history. That's my recollection. I can't swear by that. That's second and third hand.
Sure.
You know. I think somebody once told me he was their vice presidential candidate.
But who knows?
That may be a problem.
I haven't heard that anywhere.
That may be a problem. You know, yeah. But Williams went beyond simple Beardianism in that respect. And it was anything but economic determinism, because of all the emphasis on how you get inside the worldview of people. Well, the worldview is partly economic, but it's much more than that. So you're getting the relationships of ideas and material factors more explicitly with him. Yeah, but he had a charisma, I think, the rest of them didn't have, I guess.
He did.
Yeah, he did.
What kind of a professor was he? Was he the same model as Hamilton?
He wasn't as good a seminar instructor as Fred. But Fred had a kind of Socratic style to him. He actually said he was just little probing questions that would pull you out, play one off against the other, and one hand. At the end of it, he might tell you where you screwed up, you know, in the previous 2 hours. But you never knew, you know, where he was coming from most of the time. And he never indicated which books were good or bad or what have you. Everything was fair game. He read a wide diversity of things. Bill was a little more directed in his seminar, a little more intrusive in seminar. And, you know, it was more like, you know, the guru and the disciples sort of listening, what's the great man going to say now, kind of thing. So it was much more teacher-centered, which was teacher-centered, but more subtle.
Right. And
how he did it. And Harrington probably was a more polished lecturer. Harrington, most of us rarely used notes even after we went out teaching. Harrington taught us that, just either know it by rote or know what you're going to say and have it organized in your head. We would, I always had a crutch. I always had my notes up there because I never was comfortable with this, Fred. But I actually didn't use them very often unless I had a quote. Stuff that I wanted to read, you may have noticed. But he was a very polished speaker. Bill was like listening. In Bill's lectures, you could see the wheels turning because he hadn't decided at the time exactly what he was going to say. Or he'd change his mind and go off on the tangent. The tangent proved more interesting than where he thought he was going to go and what have you. He was an intellectual and you could see the wheels grinding. Yeah. At all times.
Yeah.
At all times. You know, so it was fascinating to be around. He was a better debater than Harrington.
Yeah. What do you? You said he was more charismatic.
Just personally, it's a hard. It's I don't know how you convey that. I don't know what makes a person charismatic. You know, maybe just the fact that his views were so outrageous for the time. I mean, a lot of Williams has been. I should give you a copy of the talk I gave last week to the Emeritus Luncheon. Jeremy may have known, I can't remember. It was called What Would William Have and William Say Now?
I saw the
And partly he just had a really quirky and some combative personality that made him interesting. And described before we got here, we were scared shitless opponent that he was described to as a socialist Socrates who got up on the wrong side of the bed. And sometimes he could, well, one, he was a socialist, and two, I suppose he thought like a philosopher, but sometimes he could get up on the wrong side of the bed. So, just an interesting guy. And you realize that when he's operating with a set of assumptions and premises that were quite alien to you, and if you ever accepted the premises, it's sort of all over. So we actually did, all in our own ways, did battle with him in the first year. Lloyd succumbed fairly quickly. I succumbed quite a good deal later. Walter may or may not have altogether succumbed at all, I don't know. But almost all the way, yeah.
So his graduate students generally came to the to accept his revisionism?
Yeah, I think by and large. Not always. Robert James Maddox, who was you're in the class, Maddox and stuff
like that. I think you talked about it in your
class. I probably did, Maddox. Maddox starts out here as a Williams student, and he never really bought into the revisionism. Though his first book he has probably into that, but then he becomes a very critical critic of that point of view. But he flunked prelims twice here, which he's loath to admit. And Bill actually found him a gig. He got him into Rutgers, and got Rutgers to waive prelims for him. So he actually never had to take prelims. It's my recollection. I could be wrong on that, but everything that he took here, he got counted in Rutgers, and so he was able to get through there relatively quickly.
That's nice.
Yeah, but somehow he was not grateful for it.
Still bitter.
Still bitter.
Probably would be.
Still bitter. Still bitter. But although in those days, they were written exams. They were graded and not. People didn't know who they were grading.
Oh really?
Yeah, they were 3-day exams. You took them $8 a day for 3 days. You pick them up in the morning, and their honor system, you didn't have time to crib anyway. You pick them up in the morning and you turn them back in 8 hours later, 3 days in a row. Almost everybody in the department graded them, or maybe they had 4 or 5 people for each person, I don't know how it worked. So it wasn't like Williams had flunked them out, but I don't think. In any case, I'm very poor at recreating charisma, but just to say that he had an impact on me like nobody else had before or had since, probably. Yeah.
Did you keep in touch with him for a number of years afterwards? Or
oh yeah, we became, he became quite close friends with all of us. In fact, by the time technically I was a Harrington student, so I could use Bill almost as a colleague, a friend. So by the time I'm researching my dissertation and writing it up in 59 and 60. I'm having coffee or beer with him probably once a week. And it's long since become Bill as opposed to Professor Williams. Actually, nobody used professors. Nobody said doctor, nobody said professor. It was a very egalitarian place, and the way you addressed everybody was Mr.
Really?
Mr. And for graduate students, too. I don't think... I don't think Harrington ever called us by our first name because we were well out of this. So it was always mischievous because it was an egalitarian quality.
No,
everybody
so
has the same title.
When you're sitting across the table from Lloyd Gardner, you'd say Mr. Gardner?
Yeah.
I kind of like that, I guess.
Yeah. Sure. That's my recollection at least. Yes, sure. It may have broken down by the end of the year.
The studies on the left, not something you were involved in.
Well, actually, even though I wasn't the member of the editorial board, I sort of informally was because I knew all those people. Well, at least the ones in history. There were some from English and English department, literary department, and sociology. There were other folks there, but the history people I knew quite well. I knew Weinstein. Weinstein probably provided much of money for it. Although where they got it, I don't know. They tapped into unnamed radical sources, mainly in Chicago. Who they were, where the money came from, I have no idea.
Williams helped them, hooked them up with some foundation.
I can't remember the foundation.
I think it was the Rabinowitz.
Rabinowitz. Yeah. But so I knew all those folks, fact, I wrote a very long piece for them. It was Marty Sklar, who it was. Somebody and I had a battle over the virtues of this piece, and I got pissed and pulled it out. And I later published it, I'm sorry. But eventually, I did a critique of John Rawlins, the anti-imperialism. Mm-hmm. So I could have one piece in there, at least, if not more than that. So I knew all these folks, and Lloyd Gardner knew them a bit more. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was hearing all this stuff and talking to all these people about him. So they were all close friends. And so I felt informally I was having some impact. I was writing my dissertation. I just didn't have the time.
Yeah.
I was enough of a professional. I wasn't going to take the time to do it. We had a kid. I wanted out. What have you. So you make your choices at that point. Although, we all stayed privy to the sort of conflicts that went on with that. In some ways, pretty quickly, almost from the beginning, in some ways, there was a tension within that group between whether or not we're going to make this a scholarly academic type journal where radical scholars could publish stuff that was serious scholarly stuff, mm-hmm. but nonetheless was unlikely to be looked upon with favor by the establishment journals of the day. Mm-hmm. And that was essentially most of the time was the Williams point of view. Bill was forever saying, don't even try and publish, in the Mississippi Historical Valley Review or the AHR or what have you, because they won't take you unless you water it down in ways that are essentially dishonest, so write for radical journals. And I think his notion was that it would be that kind of journal. And I think probably it was mine, it was Lloyd, it was several other folks. But there was always a tension because things are bubbling in terms of the civil rights movement already. It eventually become, of course, the anti-war movement, the tie-in as well, as to whether or not you made it a kind of forum and an advocate for movement. What's the relationship between, an intellectual and action? It was a classic tension, amongst radicals, well, anybody actually.
As I understand it, that's eventually what kind of brought the journal down.
It did.
Later in the 60s.
It did, but it was that division. That contradiction was always there. Mm-hmm. It tried to be sort of played both worlds, and eventually they fell between two schools and couldn't resolve it. Have you been through the issues over here?
I've read through the first few years when I was
yeah.
in Madison, looking for a few different things. It's impressive.
Yeah, it was for a bunch of graduate students. It wasn't
absolutely.
Bad at all.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Some of the editorial statements are interesting. Considering the state of the historical profession at the time. That these young historians, who clearly wanted to be, they wanted the academic life. They looked forward to that.
Oh, sure. Y'all did.
That they were willing to take the stance that they were.
It
was bold.
Yeah. I remember, I'm not sure how we resolved it. I suspect we resolved it different ways, but Walton, Lloyd and I would have these long debates there last year here about, when you went out to teach, did you lay out your politics? Did you lay out your assumptions? Did you lay bare your worldview? In a sense, one, is that smart to do? One, in
right.
terms of your career,
right.
In terms of where you turn the students off, it's like raving a wet flag and you give them an excuse not to come to grips with your ideas, or is it simply dishonest not to do that? There's no right answer to it. We all resolve it the same way, but I always had a preference for something, not saying labeling myself, at least saying what my operative assumptions and premises will actually were right up front. I don't know how the others resolve them. But there's always that tension.
Now, how did your politics change from when you came in 56 and you were done in like 60, 61, something like that?
60.
60.
Yeah, I took my first teaching gig at Ohio University in Athens, Ohio, fall of 1960. I just finished my PhD. I thought of myself as a socialist. Democrat. Yeah, by the time I finished. Yeah, probably well before the time I finished. Probably a couple of years into it. Probably by 58. And Lloyd did too, I'm not sure about how long.
I'm sorry, just to backtrack just for a second.
Sure.
Did Lloyd and Walt come from similar backgrounds as you?
You'll see that in the piece we wrote on
it.
We all come from religious, Protestant, middle class, Midwestern, sort of politically centrist kinds of background. Lloyd comes from Ohio Wesleyan, you know, the university, and marries the daughter of a Methodist minister, and Walt went to Hanover College, which is a evangelical reform church school in southern Indiana, grows up in Walkerton, Indiana, which is near South Bend, what have you. I grew up in what sounds like a big city, Cincinnati, but I actually grew up in a little enclave called St. Bernard, which was not incorporated into Cincinnati, and the same kind of background. It's actually just a small town environment, except for going to downtown Cincinnati on Saturday mornings. like the rest of the time, it was just a small Midwestern town, same kind of Protestant background, you know, same sort of, my grandfather was a wheeler dealer in the local Republican Party, you know, what have you. He was my political inspiration.
But that changes when you get to, that's interesting that the three of you came from such a similar backgrounds.
Yeah,
that's quite remarkable.
That's right. Well, as I said, we knew we were grappling with an anti-political point of view, and we better take it seriously and then, that's where charisma comes in. I think you have to have somebody who challenges you enough that you're nonetheless willing to let your ideas rub up against his and do battle, you know, with his and like. And not many people can persuade you to do that. It was almost by sheer force. He was a very charming guy when he wanted to be, you know. So some of that's in that with you, because they will read that history. So, you know, I thought of myself that way ever since. I mean, in some ways, socialism is kind of a moot point these days. So I find myself mainly admiring European capitalism. You take what you can get.
Yeah.
So you want, take capitalism with a human face that, has some degree of constraint on the ability of the market to in a sense, exploit workers, consumers, and environment at will. and the like. And, I mean, I won't be altogether comfortable with that, but, that's okay.
Yeah.
It's okay, because the one thing about all the Williams types, they're not Norman Thomas socialists, but nonetheless they're democratic socialists. We're never great admirers of, a Stalinist system.
Right.
And like, we always sort of wrote it off to state capitalism. One hand, but we all recognized, in a sense, it's an issue we never resolved. Guys like E.H. Carr spent a life trying to resolve it. How do you find a substitute for the hunger whip? How do you make people work if they don't have to work? And given human nature, there may be no substitute for it. So you can be a socialist of the heart, but say of the mind, well, I don't know. I don't have an answer for that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I see that. Whenever I see an advertisement for someone talking about socialism on campus, my first thought is, exactly what is socialism? It doesn't really have any meaning, concrete meaning. I don't know if it ever did, but it certainly doesn't today.
Today it seems like it's a good point for the moment.
For the moment.
For the moment, yeah.
You never know, right?
It do go in cycles when the next great crash, of course, like radicals forever waiting for something catastrophic to happen, which seems to be an odd thing to do.
It's got to get worse before it can get better. I've never subscribed to that theory myself.
Yeah, me neither, actually, to be truthful. Yeah, I have some daughters and some grandkids that got to live in that catastrophic time. I don't wish it on anybody.
Absolutely. When you were a grad student, so you're in the humanities, or did they consider social sciences?
Humanities. Yeah.
Were you aware in the 50s and early 60s that kind of the money in higher education was not moving in your direction?
We could not be unaware.
Yeah.
And the reason we couldn't be unaware was that Fair Harvey Harrington made his political reputation and political career, which later resulted in his becoming president of this university, made it by fighting that. Because in the beginning, WARF money is entirely for the sciences, for the natural sciences. There's no money at all. It's going to the ag school, it's going to this and that, or the hard sciences. There's none going to humanities, none going even to the so-called social sciences like sociology and Harrington makes his career in the faculty senate almost entirely on that issue. I mean, he becomes a troublemaker over that issue, and he rallies all kinds of influential people around him.
And then eventually moves into the administration.
But eventually gets dwarfed to change its position and make humanities and social science people eligible to apply for Wharf grants and Wharf money. Mm-hmm. You know, time off and summer relief and semester relief and this and that. You know. And so, you know, we're quite aware of that just from our relationship with him. I'm not sure that everybody else was. You know, I'm not sure if you'd have asked a field student if they understood what was happening. But we certainly did.
What about other things in terms of kind of the university? Well, since this is what I'm thinking about in terms of my particular project, the university and the Cold War. You know, and this increasing cooperation, integration of the university into kind of into being an instrument in some ways.
Yeah.
Never completely, but in some ways an instrument of the Cold War, of the federal government.
You know, I think there was concern about it, but I it was less curiously for a bunch of people to call themselves, materialists. Curiously less about the money. We were concerned about faculty on campus recruiting for the CIA amongst their students, things of that sort. So it was more at a kind of personal level than a kind of institutional funding sort of level. And I can only speak for myself that, in some ways it isn't until, the 60s and the Clark Kerr and the multi-universities and things. It isn't until the early stages of the Vietnam War that the complicity becomes so obvious and overt. So at least I can't say that was something much on my mind at that point.
I haven't really found much about it prior to, there was a course on campus given by the Extension about how to construct civil defense shelters. And it was sponsored by the Pentagon, and this was the first kind of uproar that I ever found any evidence.
When was this?
I think in 1963.
Yeah, I was going to say, this would be an early 60s thing. I mentioned before I was teaching at Athens, Ohio then, and that was, the Kennedy years brought out the big bomb shelter sort of stuff. It was never a great environment, Kennedy. The people he surrounded himself in the beginning scared them out of me. But I remember, the main street in the little town of Athens, Ohio, the courthouse had constructed outside it a model bomb shelter, and encouraging people to go to their local construction firms and build and follow the model bomb shelter. But I thought the ultimate irony was in the pre-Christmas season that Santa Claus sat inside the bomb shelter to meet the little kids to go sit on his lap.
Bizarre.
Only in America.
Santa in the bomb shelter.
Exactly so. I didn't take my kids. We're kids by that point.
That's pretty good.
But, prior to the time I leave here in 60, I just don't recall much awareness of that kind of conflict. I think all of us still lived in a Cardinal Newman ivory tower. We all, most of us probably implicitly, if not explicitly, chose academic life, not because we thought it was going to be cushy, because the pay in those days was terrible. In the 70s and 80s and what have you, where everybody else is treading water, academic salaries go up substantially relative to the rest of society. Mm-hmm. So relative to, let's say, an average worker, we were not well paid, at that time. So it wasn't for the money, and maybe it was for, that kind of cushy academic sort of life in which you could get the off on summers and things of the sort and get to do things like write books. But essentially it was an escape from the corporate world. I didn't, almost everybody said, I didn't want to be a businessman. It was an anti-business attitude, even amongst people who might be conservative. anti-business attitude. You know, that, it, it was all, that was the, you know, if there was a self-criticism in the 50s, it's all about conformity. It's all about the man in the gray flannel suit. Mm-hmm. It's all, you know, it's all about the white, you know, white collar elites and blah, 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 blah. You know, and we're all critical of that, almost regardless of one's party politics and all.
So that, so you.
I think we still. Yeah, I think we still saw the academic world as enough like that, enough of an escape that we didn't see the fact that, you know, it was not, you know, the difference was not that great. And it really isn't. You know, after I left here, Williams and I corresponded constantly. We talked on the phone a lot too. But I could see him start to complain. That is, you know, that the university was starting to look like a corporation. That his younger colleagues coming in were also young professionals on the make, and they were all building careers and leaders and what have you. And it wasn't the world of ideas. You couldn't talk history to it because they were doing, you know, other kinds of things. They're busy promoting themselves,
right.
In a sense. So he starts referring to them as the men in the gray flannel suits. I suspect one of the reasons he leaves here in the late 60s.
The bomb.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes when I read stuff about the 50s, the bomb, the kind of cloud of nuclear war was hanging over some people, and other people were kind of oblivious to it. Was it something that you and your colleagues at the time were thinking about or talking about at all?
Yeah. Yes and no. It's something we all, I think, worried a bit. Some of the reason why some of us would circulate amongst all the people that ended up on studies, like, and essentially they were, how can we find a way so that American capitalism still has enough of an outlet for its psychic and economic energies without having to be a global system that brings us forever at every point along the periphery in the conflict with the Soviets and makes the possibility of the bomb, you know, falling an even likelier thing. Some was pretty reactionary. Third world people would have hated us at that point. I hate myself now. But how can we rationalize Latin America as an empire so we don't need Asia and the Middle East kind of thing?
We're trading countries here.
You know, it was almost like, you know, Fortress America stuff, like, you know, capitalism in one hemisphere. Sort of bit. So, and I think the bomb was that. I think there was always this awareness that, you know, the balance of terror might not always hold up and the like. On the other hand, I mean, speaking for myself at least, the Cuban Missile Crisis didn't have a great impact on me.
Really?
I wasn't scared. I don't know why. I didn't think it was going to happen.
Yeah.
And I remember being on radio talk shows in which they were analyzing, okay, why did the Russians do this? And it was at an analytical level, you know, what's the nature of our response and why? You know, what, you know, I suppose if I'd been privy to some of the internal debates that were going on, you know, inside the executive committee, I might have been a little more scared.
Yeah.
And like Lloyd, on the other hand, I know it was. Lloyd was actually in the Air Force at the Cape Canaveral, and they were, you know, mobilizing everything.
Yeah,
down in Florida, they were mobilizing everything.
Yeah.
And the like. But I also remember, I don't think I ever formally joined, but when I was teaching in Athens, Ohio in the early 60s, went to meetings of SANE, you know, the society that's beginning to get under their thing. And I dropped out after, you know, a couple months maybe. Because they almost felt, in order to legitimize their opposition to the bomb, that they almost had to establish their Cold War credentials. And so their anti-communism was, I thought, unnecessarily virulent, given my own perception that there wasn't any communism by that point in this time in the society that was, in fact, much of a menace at all. And like, and so this sort of waving the red, you know, the anti-red flag was a put-off, turn-off for me. And I accepted their goals in terms of an anti-nuke sort of bit, and what have you, and limits on atomic, you know, above-ground testing and things of that sort, you know. I couldn't take their domestic politics, in part because I could see they were doing it as a calculation and like to establish bona fides.
Right.
So.
They were caught in kind of a hard place.
They were. I mean, looking back on it in retrospect, I'm more sympathetic.
Right. But at the time,
to them at the time, yeah. You know, in particularly because the emphasis was so on the bomb, and it sort of extracted the whole context in which I understood the world, and they weren't going to take me on at that level. They weren't going to look at the any structural or contextual reasons why there might be a Cold War. It was all about, you know, there is a Cold War, but just let's not do the bomb.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing. So it was a very simple issue.
Well, speaking of McCarthyism
anti-communism,
was that something that you ever experienced in Wisconsin or saw, whether you experienced it or not, or any of your colleagues?
I didn't experience it personally, nor did I. Did I really ever experience it as a teacher, to be honest? Yeah. On the other hand, keep in mind that really by the time we get here, McCarthy himself is on the wane,
right.
You know, and dies while we're still here in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Bill encountered it firsthand, Bill Williams. And one of the things I talked about in that luncheon talk a week or two ago was that it's hard to remember the context that what Bill Williams was saying and writing at the time was regarded as subversive, criminal, not treasonous. And what happened is some both sides are responsible for the Cold War, and we had some internal structural reasons why we were out there not simply saving the world, but reasons for being out there as we always had.
Yeah.
That got him in a lot of trouble.
At the university or in the broader community?
In the broader community. There's a very conservative Republican Assembly guy, Freilich, or was he a senator? I can't remember. His name is Freilich, and he calls him up before the sort of Wisconsin version of the House Un-American Activities Committee. This came out at the luncheon. Bill went in wearing his dress whites. He was a graduate of the as you probably know, the Annapolis Academy, Naval Academy. Medals from World War II, wounded veteran, spent a year or 6 months or whatever it was in a hospital bed after the war. And Freilich didn't know what to do with that. He asked him a few polite questions. I may have told you the story in the class, because I often like to repeat it about myself. They asked Bill Williams what he did, and he said, I teach. And they asked him what he taught. He said, I teach people how to think. Not what to think, but how to think. You know, just how to think critically. Think critically about your own worldview, your own assumptions and premises and what have you. And all authority figures, of course, including the one that's telling you to do this.
Yeah.
But they let him off easy. He then called before the House Un-American Activities Committee as well. Mm-hmm. I don't think he actually ever had to appear. He had some really high-powered lawyers that made life difficult for the committee.
Yeah.
I think he sat outside in the waiting room decided not to call him. But somebody else in the audience, Mike Clover, retired in ancient history, reminded us that there was a big review in Time magazine, one of Williams' work, it may have been The Tragedy, it may have been Contours, I can't remember. It posts the book, it's characterizing this as a really forward-looking, creative, provocative kind of point of view in Time magazine, saying, if this is true, then American universities are in big, big trouble, you know?
Sure.
And, of course, it is a kind of, the profession itself wielded a kind of McCarthyism.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's subjected to not only a great deal of criticism, but a great deal of ridicule. Oscar Hanlon writes a review of Contour and asks, you know, is this an elaborate joke or is this man serious? You know,
mm-hmm.
Who knows? You know,
mm-hmm.
It's sort of like, is this guy a genius or a crack level? I think he's a crack level.
Yeah.
Kind of did. So, and Williams certainly never got big offers from other, he was one of the lesser paid people in his department, is what I understand.
Really?
Because he never got big offers from other places because it was
too controversial. It's interesting that you mention it. It is hard to fathom that he was perhaps the only academic historian who was making this argument in 58.
That's right. Because now, well, of course, sometimes perversely, but now the notion of American empire is accepted if not celebrated. I had some. I couldn't resist the, as Walt LePeber described it, a kind of drive-by shooting of Niall Ferguson in his talk. And I said, well, you know, much of what Williams has said is now sort of celebrated and accepted into the vocabulary and what have you. Even if his ideas are cherry-picked a little bit, you take part of it, you ignore the larger structural analysis and what have you. But I had some sort of reference to Niall Ferguson, one of these, and lookalikes, celebrating good empire, and suggested that Bill might have said something to the fact that if you want to talk about good empire, probably of all the so-called good empires, the most good was, in fact, the British Empire in the 17th and 18th century, and the American Revolution said what they thought of good empires.
That's true. We clearly didn't think that much about our post-both. Very true. You mentioned that your own view of the Soviet Union was state-sponsored capitalism.
Yeah.
Was that a common? There wasn't a lot of sympathy for the Soviet Union.
No. Again, even those who grew up in that kind of pro-Soviet background, there's a terrific amount of disillusion after 56. But it already started, of course, with the Khrushchev 52-53 Congress stuff attacking Stalinist sins, if you will. I think you'd be hard pressed to find any very positive in those times. And of course, for those of us who came out of not a red diaper baby background, but a totally different kind of background, this is not something we'd ever, our immersion into socialism is simply a little to the left of Norman Thomas, probably. So it probably never would occur to us. Only in one sense, and that is that you at times I think you perhaps out of ignorance or another way set aside what's happening in the Soviet Union, often because you don't know what's happening inside the Soviet Union. Set it aside, and if you're focusing on foreign policy, then you're saying, well, to put this entirely in terms of Soviet expansionism and American defense of a free world against Soviet expansionism misses the dynamics of what's happening. And we're not exactly sure what the Soviets are up to, why they're up, but we also know that this is rather consistent with our own past. And even if there were no Soviet Union, we would have been following pretty much the same kind of foreign policy. And indeed, most of the people that make foreign policy in the post-Cold War period, like Adolf Berle and Acheson and what have you, are talking about the kind of world they're going to make in 1940, 1941, even before we're in the war.
Right.
They know what kind of world. It's pretty much the same world we make. There's a Marshall Plan, whether or not there's a Soviet Union or not. There's a Japanese reverse course, whether or not there's a Soviet Union or not. So if you get focused on that issue, as we tend to be in terms of our own training, then almost out of ignorance, you commit a sin. That is to say, sin is a too strong word. But we knew a lot about the domestic side of America, and we could see the connection between the domestic contacts and foreign policy. What we didn't know about in any kind of detail, because none of us have Russian, none of us have training in Russian history, and the sources are terrible anyway, because everybody's just making guesses about what's happening in Russia because of so much disinformation and misinformation coming out, including a kind of exaggerated strength. So we don't look at the same. It's not a true international history study because we're not doing the same thing on the Soviet side that we do, on our side.
Right.
But to get back to your point, I don't think any of us were enamored of the Soviet Union at any point in your time. I think there may have been some, that enamored is the wrong word, but are fascinated by the Cuban Revolution. Mm-hmm. We're fascinated by even some, by a few, maybe by the Chinese Revolution. I remember one person going to China, one of the first ones there, coming back and saying, you know, oh, there, you know, there are no prostitutes and flies in China. Yeah. Socialism is not the job.
I know Studies does an episode on Cuba, and there's a lot of excitement about the revolution.
There was. And Williams writes a book on Cuba called The U.S. and Cuba.
When did he write that book?
Well, it's very early on.
Was that in the mid-60s or something?
Even before. I think he writes it even before the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think he writes it in 61 or 62.
Okay.
Yeah. I think largely because, you know, folks almost saw it not as a communist revolution. They saw it as kind of, you know, there was a kind of idealization of it, a kind of grassroots, sort of up by the bootstraps, you know, peasant third world rebellion, what have you. So there's a lot of utopianism that goes into that. You know, in retrospect, a lot of us sort of negate the difficulties that any one island with a monoculture, one crop economy is going to have in creating a viable economy without substantial outside inputs. They're almost, if we thought about it, there was almost no way for them to make it without Soviet input. I mean, it may be possible to have socialism in one country, but it better be a pretty damn big country.
With a diverse economy.
With a very diverse economy.
I can't believe Castro's still hanging on.
Saul, when I saw Saul last week, I mean, Saul's made many trips to Cuba. His daughter is actually going to medical school in Havana.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. They have someone, he said it was the one good thing Colin Powell ever did. Under pressure from the Black Caucus, who said to him, it's very expensive, and the academic requirements are such in American med schools that people of color in this country have a hard time getting into American med schools. Who can afford $100,000 a year to go to med school, this or that, whatever.
Yeah.
You know. And Havana has a noted reputation for good med schools. They're providing most of the doctors for Chavez's Venezuela.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They're almost entirely Cuban doctors. They're like his Venezuela headman. All that sent to Rockefeller Oil didn't produce a medical profession. So it's excellent. It's an excellent med school. And like in Havana. So she's not a person of color, but she went anyway. He's been there a lot. But last time he was there, he was saying he doesn't know how Castro does it. It's, you know, like the magic wand or something, because nothing actually seems to be produced there. You know, things you get, people consume, and they complain.
Produce.
Yeah, but you know, it's hard to see where the economic activity is. That's secondhand, so I wouldn't quote that from Saul. From Saul. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. I want to make sure I don't put words in his mouth. You know, so.
What do you think about the, having been an undergraduate in the 50s and then a graduate student, what do you think about the label of the silent generation for the 50s? Does it fit?
It's a tough question, actually.
I'm kind of struggling with it myself.
Yeah. I mean, we may have been silent, but, you know, we weren't, you know, deaf, blind, and dumb. There were anxieties about the times in which we lived. I mentioned before the great flannel suit sense, the sense of our own self-criticism of conformity.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, you know, people like Gardner's Lefebvre's McCormick's, you know, they have to be, you know, they have to be open to some ideas to begin with. They, in some ways, at some level, conscious or unconscious, they have to be looking for something else that was more persuasive, more aesthetically, idealistically satisfying than what they were getting. I mean, I think the whole 50s lays a set of preconditions, maybe out of, you know, negatively lays preconditions for the 60s. All these 60s are kids are children of somebody, and they're not just rebelling against their parents. A lot of their parents are already, right, you know, ill at ease. I mean, you forget even in feminist terms. Now, early in the '60s, Betty Friedan's the feminist critique, this mystique, comes out, and the kind of resonance that gets immediately,
right,
you know. Because there's not that much time that's elapsed between Rosie the Riveter and this. We're only talking about a 15-year period of time, and you know, people didn't turn into stone during those 15 years. They still had memories, they still had feelings, they still had hopes, and what have you. And they had dissatisfactions, what have you. So, no period is quite as dead as the 50s has made it out, been made out to be, you know. Sense. And, you know, even on the issue of race, I mean, you can't underestimate the impact that the desegregation stuff has on people's consciousness and all. Forgive the digression, I was just remembering a party at the Marty Sklar's in which we sat around listening to Mort Saul's The Future Lies Ahead record. It's all about Eisenhower wanting to take the little girl by the hand and lead her into the Arkansas schoolhouse, but he couldn't make up his mind between an overlapping and an interlapping grip, you know, take off on the golf stuff.
Yeah.
What have you. So that was very much on our mind, and the like, all these things happen. And desegregation of the armed forces, what have you. So the race issue is there. Even on this campus, forgetting the graduate students that might be immersed in some weird and radical analysis, what have you, there's a fairly massive sort of teach-in demonstration on the steps of the student union that spills all the way, fills the space between the library and the historical society, and spreads up Langdon Street against American intervention in Lebanon. In 1958. Yeah, the Eisenhower doctor.
Did you participate in that?
I wasn't a speaker, but some historians were. I can't remember which ones anymore. Yeah.
The Eisenhower doctor.
Yeah.
I still
but we were out there in the crowd cheering.
I tell my, when I teach foreign policy sometimes as a teaching assistant, I talk about this notion of doctrines and foreign policy.
Yeah, I love the word.
Doctrine,
the sacrosanct quality that it gives. It's not a policy, it's a doctrine.
Something special.
Yes.
And that was in 1958 that happened.
Yeah, that's right.
So what was the, this is a tough question, and I guess I'm asking for a little bit of speculation. What was the difference between the 50s and the 60s? You know, what happened? was it the ending of McCarthyism, the gradual ending of that? Was it the civil rights movement? Was it, or is it just a lot of things?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not well placed to answer it in some ways. And yet, if immediately in the fall of 1960 you get plunged into an academic environment and you don't have quite the same relationship with students that you did, and you're also teaching in a kind of, I don't mean this critically, but Athens, Ohio, and Ohio University are kind of out of the backwash of things that are happening, and it's not necessarily a very representative student body, even necessarily representative sort of faculty. And again, you got family and this and that. So in some ways, there's a period from about 1960 to 1964 in which I almost don't know what's happening, except what's happening inside myself, or what's happening in correspondence with the Williams or my friends or what have you, or reading studies on the left or reading the National Magazine, what have you. But I don't know firsthand.
Yeah.
It's almost not until I get to the University of Pittsburgh in 64. Although I should back up. I take it back. There actually, John Cady, who was chairman of the department in Athens, Ohio, who'd been on the Burma desk of the State Department and left because of McCarthyism.
Really?
Not because himself was a conservative, lay Methodist type guy, but he realized that he couldn't write any policy analysis or any policy recommendation unless he couched it in terms of the communist threat in Southeast Asia, and generally in Burma specifically, even though he knew there wasn't that or it wasn't, or if it was, it was so local and regionalized that it had no consequence for American national interest. But he couldn't write it that, you know, he couldn't tell the truth because it wouldn't go above the next ladder. So it was wasting his time sort of writing. So he kind of, and he actually had a kind of teaching on Southeast Asia in spring of 1963, a little bit of a teacher. Yeah. But it's not till I get to Pittsburgh, where one, the war issue has already become an issue by then, so I get involved in the teaching movement there. First one in 1965, which was against not only Vietnam, but equally against the intervention of the Dominican Republic in 65, so it's kind of a joint.
Two for one?
You got it. I love to tell you a story about this. But we also, at that time, get involved in the civil rights movement. Dave Montgomery, a great labor historian, who comes out of a radical background, married to a black woman, very active in the civil rights movement.
In Pittsburgh at the time?
In Pittsburgh at the time. He later goes to Yale. He's now retired. Dave and his wife, Margaret, who became very close friends there. And so, you know, we do all the civil rights marches, and we frankly live in the Hill District of which is the black district of
Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Although that's in part because I'm a jazz enthusiast. It's the only place to hear jazz
good
in
reason
town.
To be there.
Yeah. And the way. Although, curiously, by the end of the teaching movement, I'm sort of on the outs with it. My last teacher, and I actually get booed at teaching, as Williams sometimes.
You weren't radical enough?
It was too radical.
Too radical.
Too radical. Okay. In an interesting sense. I mean, Williams had the same problem. As we both tend to, at times, to see the student anti-war movement as anti-intellectual and ahistorical, and missing a grand opportunity to actually educate themselves about, you know, the larger kind of context over time and space and society and the like. And we all sort of thought they'd get pretty easily co-opted into the Democratic Party as soon as the Democratic Party made its left turn to the left, which is, you know, not entirely wrong, as it turned out.
Right, absolutely.
But I got pissed off. I was, I think this is maybe in my last year there, which would have been 69. I can't remember his name, but he was an economics professor. And he and I knew each other pretty well at the time. I think Ray Richmond, is that his name? But in any case, he had some understanding of the economics of the Indochina War. Not in terms of silly stuff, in terms of the Americans wrapped their chin in his tungsten, but you may recall from my own class that there's a kind of effort to recreate a kind of co-prosperity sphere, to rebuild the Japanese economy, both for its own sake and the trading system which was involved, but also to block Chinese expansion, give China an enticement to turn toward capitalism, I mentioned things of that sort. That there are larger issues, particularly for the Japanese economy, in terms of creating an outlet for it at that point in time. And, you know, not many people understood it at that point in time, but so I sort of did, and he sort of did, and I knew that. And he got up and he lied. And he said, there are no economic reasons for this war, it's a moral issue. And that's what they were all doing, because it was the least common denominator. You know, you hit people where they live. It's an issue of moral outrage. This is an evil, amoral war. As if all wars aren't evil, amoral in most instances.
Right.
And like, it's singling this one out. And I got pissed at him, and I got pissed at the crowd's reaction, because they seemed to be very self-congratulatory, because they were moral, and the other guys on the other side were immoral.
They weren't willing to see the larger issues, the connections.
That's right. And, you know, I lectured them. I told them what it was about. I said, you know, if you want to take the time to understand your own history, you understand, you know, the larger, you know, the kind of structural situation in which all this takes place and why it will go on happening after Vietnam is over, and you've long since left this place, then you're just wasting your time, just patting yourself on the back. And Shane Lee Park was nearby. I said, you know, go out and make love with Shane Lee Park. Just, you know, do something useful.
They were not too happy about that, huh?
I don't have a short fuse, but I have one that long for some reason.
Well, those were different times.
They were, yeah. and then went to a and then went to a fraternity party immediately after because they had a good band playing. You know, so
good jazz band.
Actually, this is a rock band. I was just starting to get into rock as well at that point.
You know,
yeah. So, to go back to your original question, I don't. It's not until the mid to late 60s that I have much of a handle on the 60s in some ways.
Yeah.
Transmitted situation. So I'm probably not a good resource person for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of runs through my questions.
Okay. Good.
Very helpful.
Well, I hope so. Yeah. But do feel free to use my name. Write Saul again.
Okay.
And see if it'll deal with you.
Well, now I have two people that have suggested I email him, so maybe he'll respond. I'm sure he's very busy. Maybe he just missed it in the...
He may have,
I'll try him again.
Yeah. Very interesting guy. Yeah.
It sounds like it. He's one of the people...
Very funny.